baby, you're casting your spell on me. I say, boogum, 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 now, baby, you're casting your spell on me.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of this Skip to the End podcast. As ever, I'm Ben.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Adam.
And on this week's show, we're going to be discussing a couple of topics that we set last week. Favourite cinematic deaths, favourite cinema soundtracks. We've also got our homework that we set for ourselves last week and our DVD challenge. And we'll also be reviewing A Most Wanted Man, one of the final film performances of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman. So let's get started.
Right, guys, so following on from last week, I asked you both to take some time out to work out what was your favourite soundtracks. How's it gone this week?
All right.
Pretty good, actually. I thought it would be easier than it was. There are so many good ones, which I think we'll see when the three of us speak about ours and we get some from the listeners as well.
Yeah, I think the struggle was sort of narrowing it down, because there's a lot of... And the difference between soundtrack and score.
And a score, yeah. Me and Mark were discussing that earlier. Because there were a couple of ones that we sort of dismissed, like Drive, that are great, but they're more scored.
It's more of a score, yeah. It's The Dark Knight.
Well, anything with Hans Zimmer is going to be flawless, but yeah. Right, Ben, go for it. Let's see what you got.
My first one is Trainspotting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
A fantastic film. A film that I sort of revisit every, I don't know, 4 or 5 years.
I must say, I've not seen this for about 5 years, probably.
I was waiting for you about to say, I've not seen Trainspotting.
It's the earliest homework in history. So it's a great film. One of the things that always stands out to me is the soundtrack. And I've singled out a couple of songs here that I want to bring your attention to. There's Lust for Life, Iggy Pop. I don't think I'd ever heard of Iggy Pop when I first watched this film. Obviously, because I was too young to watch the film. That's certainly true. And I wasn't familiar with him. And this song just blew me away. And the scene where Renton is running down the street. He's being chased and he nearly gets run over by the car. And it's a fantastic scene. And the song matches up with the scene so well.
I remember it being on the trailer loads. That's the song that they kind of advertised the film with.
Yeah.
And that's the one I always... So if I ever hear that song now, I don't think of Iggy Pop. I think of... Yeah, like you said, Ewan McGregor sprinting down the street with his shaved head.
I think that's one of the great things about a good soundtrack in a film. It's not just the song, the fact that it invokes memories of the actual film.
Yeah.
And the other song from Trainspotting that does that for me is Perfect Day by Lou Reed.
Hmm? Yeah.
Yeah.
That is completely linked with that. Now, the only other thing it makes me think of, there was some really awful BBC advert that had it on as well. But it makes me think of Trainspotting, and that's just another great song. And that's another scene where I think Renton is he's OD'd.
Yeah.
And that's a really powerful scene, the soundtrack by that particular song. And then there are loads of other good songs on it as well, like Born Slippy by Underworld. And that's the one that's Lager, 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 isn't it?
Incredible.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a really good film and a really good soundtrack.
Brilliant. So I'll go on from here. I think I've mentioned this in a previous episode, but Almost Famous, one of my favourite films. Cameron Crowe, just unbelievable. The soundtrack itself, for me, is one of those ones that after I saw the film, I think I went to HMV straight afterwards and bought it. I was obsessed with it. To give you an idea of some of the tracks that really stuck out for me, he's given a box of records in the film from his sister who's going away, and that's what introduces him to the music scene and the kind of life of rock and roll and gets his career all started in music. For me, this track is The Who, Sparks. Unbelievable track. He lights a candle, puts his record on, you see this, and it's just, well, The Who for me are a great band anyway.
Incredible.
Another one is Simon and Garfunkel, America. So I think it's, I can't actually remember which part of the film it's from, but it's another standout track. And the one that is always my favourite is Tiny Dancer by Elton John.
Okay.
So the band themselves have had a real bad time on the road. It's all gone to shit. They're all at the point where I think they're about to break up. The drummer's going to quit. They're literally at the lowest of all low. They sit on the bus, they're driving, and suddenly one of the band members starts singing it on an acoustic, and they all start singing together. But no, it's before that film, I probably wouldn't have listened to Tiny Dancer by Elton John, but I'll always go back to that. And like you said, Adam, it takes me exactly to that moment
of the film.
And
invokes that scene for you in your head, and I think that's one of the, as I said before, the great things about a soundtrack, where it literally pulls you back into a scene in a film, because you just automatically recognise it from there.
Yeah.
Well, me next then. So we're going to lead off with a film that actually came out recently.
Yeah.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Amazing.
Cool film, cool soundtrack.
Absolutely love the soundtrack. Actually downloaded Awesome Mix Volume 1. Pick out a few tracks. Redbone, Come Get Your Love. Starting sequence.
Yeah. Oh,
what a surprise. Again, talking about invoking memories of a scene, it's just dragged me straight back to Star-Lord dancing through that temple.
Incredible.
Picking up the sort of alien rats and singing into a mic, like pretending they're a microphone. Fantastic. And then Ooh Child with the final scene where he's having that kind of little dance against Ronan the Accuser.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just absolutely hilarious. But in that entire soundtrack from start to finish, there are moments that just pull you back. Dancing Groot, Want You Back.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's one of the best-selling soundtracks this year, I reckon. Everyone I know that's seen that film have gone and bought the soundtrack.
Yeah, and a hell of a lot of people have seen that film, so I reckon it's sold like hotcakes.
Definitely. If you look at the trailer as well, when they led off with Blue Swede, Hooked on a Feeling.
Yeah.
I think, for some reason, that kind of hooked a lot of people into the trailer.
Yeah.
Just for how catchy that song was. And it only actually has a brief spell in the actual film. I think it's just one scene where the guy's putting the headphones on, and Chris Pratt as Star-Lord just says, hey, that's mine.
My second choice is Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah.
It's a soundtrack that I had probably 10, 15 years ago, and I loved it, and I used to listen to it non-stop, and then I haven't listened to it in quite some time. So I went back and I looked at it, and a couple of the songs that stood out to me now, as they did then, are Little Green Bag by George Baker Selection, mm-hmm. and of course Stuck in the Middle of You, With You by Steeler's Wheel.
Now that, to me, is the prime example of a song taking you back to a scene in the film.
Exactly, yeah, it's the ear-cutting scene.
It's
so whenever you hear that song, you think of that. But something that surprised me when I was looking back at the track listing yesterday, and this links in nicely to your first choice, Adam, is that on the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack is Hooked on a Feeling by Blue Swede. And I had completely forgotten that.
Maybe Hollywood needs to sort of stand up and take notice. Maybe that song is kind of like a good luck charm for a film.
Yeah.
That's his music for this episode sorted.
Wasn't that the music for the first episode?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think we've got a chance of that being a good luck charm for us.
Reservoir Dogs, again, great film, great soundtrack. Like you said, Adam, certain songs, especially Stuck in the Middle with You, it just takes you right back to the film.
That's a very good... I mean, you can always pick out anything by Tarantino.
He's a master of curating great soundtracks.
Exactly. That must have been difficult to kind of pick Reservoir Dogs among anything. Obviously, I've not had your number three yet, but to pick Reservoir Dogs amongst all of Tarantino's films.
Absolutely. Like, I considered Pulp Fiction in my top three, because that's a hell of a soundtrack as well, but for me, Reservoir Dogs just pipped it.
For me, the next one is Cameron Crowe again. This one is Singles. Have you seen this film?
I must admit, I've not.
Oh!
Well, early homework. You'll love it. It's actually got Pearl Jam in the film themselves.
Incredible. It is a very grungy film, if I remember it rightly.
So the soundtrack on this is my music taste down to a T. It's all the Seattle kind of Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Mudhoney. But there's also, I suppose, the further talent like Smashing Pumpkins, Screaming Trees. But the tracks that really stand out for me is Wood by Alice in Chains, State of Love and Trust. So, as you know, I'm a massive Pearl Jam fan. They must have 500 songs, but that song for me is their best, finest piece of music they've done. And then Drown by the Smashing Pumpkins, which is an absolute unbelievable tune. I won't tell you at what point the songs are used in the film because you've not seen it, but I'd like to hear your thoughts next week on that, because it's just such a good film.
No, definitely. Look forward to watching it. Well, I've already talked about this before. I've even set it as homework, The Graduate.
Yeah.
One of the reasons it was in my top five was I thought the soundtrack was incredible. And it is. I mean, I don't think I really need to pick out any songs from it. I mean, you can talk about The Sound of Silence is probably one of the most incredible opening song I've seen in a film, when he's just going down the escalator and it's kind of his shadow.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And then Mrs. Robinson's on there, Scarborough Fair's on there. I mean, it's just a fantastic soundtrack overall, and every kind of song plays a part in the film. And I think that's what you get when you do have sort of one or two people writing songs and then producing a soundtrack for a film.
It's more cohesive. It's like the work that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross have been doing for David Fincher films of late.
Exactly.
I mean, they're more scores than soundtracks, but because they're curated or written by the same people, it's more cohesive across the film.
To be honest, this is the thing about scores versus soundtracks as well. Like you mentioned Hans Zimmer at the start of this. If he writes a score, he writes it to fit the entire film. It's not just one song or one score to fit parts of the film. It literally fits the entire thing. So The Graduate for me is number two.
Yeah, and I'm not a Simon and Garfunkel fan by any stretch. Folk music's not my cup of tea, but the music does work so beautifully with the film, the tone of the film.
And I think that's, again, a sign of a good soundtrack. Because if it fits the film, even if you don't like that type of music, you still... You kind of nod along with it and you're like, yeah, okay.
I really like your comment there, like, because if you think to yourself 14, 15 tracks by the same artist for one film, you're going to get bored by the end. But I think, like, yeah, you've nailed it there. Like, Simon and Garfunkel, they're known for being unbelievable, but you don't get bored of hearing Simon, you know, Paul Simon's voice throughout.
There's a couple of different songwriters kind of chucked in there throughout the film, but it's the sort of the crux of the soundtrack is those guys, Simon and Garfunkel. And it just seems a lot more cohesive than other soundtracks, as you mentioned. So I think that's why I've kind of picked that out, and that's why I love that soundtrack so much.
Well, that's talking about The Graduate there and having one artist or a couple of artists doing most of the music, that links quite nicely into my third one. I've gone for Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, fantastic.
A film that I know we all love. And across the soundtrack, there are various different bands, but the thing about it that I love is... Anyone out there listening, if you've not seen the film, sort yourself out, go and see it. But effectively what it's about is the lead character, Scott Pilgrim, and his various misadventures with the ex-lovers of his new girlfriend. And he's also in a band called the Sex Bob-Oms. And the band within the film play various gigs and play various songs, all of which in real life were written by Beck. In the film, they're played by the real actors. Yeah. So Michael Cera and the other guys, Alison Pill, they actually play the songs for real. But then on the soundtrack... You have two versions of the main song, so you've got got the cast version, which you hear in the film, and then you have the original versions by Beck. There are a couple that I just want to make reference to. There's one called We Are Sex Bob-Omb that introduces you to the band. There's one called Threshold that's great, and another one called Garbage Truck. And if anyone wants to check those out, you know, I would certainly go and seek them out and listen to both the cast versions and Beck's original versions, because they're brilliant stuff.
Cool. I mean, I must admit, I do love the soundtrack for Scott Pilgrim versus the World as well. I think it's a fantastic film, and it's, again, one of those situations where the music fits so well.
I remember I can't believe I've left that off, how much I love that film. I'm kicking myself now thinking, how have I not thought of that? But
I'm quite glad you did, because Ben chose it.
Yeah, no, it's good.
An awful third choice to you turn around next and went, Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
What I really remember about that film is the way they, Edgar Wright kind of, adds the music to the certain scenes as well. So I remember there's one scene where, what's the main guy? Sorry, Michael
Cera.
Yeah, he's standing there having a conversation with his guitar in his hand. He's just plucking this one note of the guitar. I think it's a bass guitar, and it's just ringing out. And as he pans out, it's actually him with the guitar playing the music to start that track, said. And it's unbelievable the way it works, because you're sitting there hearing this note, and then there's this, oh, it's him playing it. And it kicks straight into the actual, like you said, the band doing it. And I didn't realise there was two different versions for each one, so I'm going to have to
definitely be checking that out myself as well.
I might go on Spotify and download that.
or one of the other previous services.
So for next, for me, it's not actually a film directed by Cameron Crowe. It's Dazed and Confused. Have either of you seen that?
I have not.
Right then. Why am I always me sitting there with you guys? Dazed and Confused, I think it's a 90s film, a proper stoner film.
Yeah.
We don't endorse drugs. And, proper stoner film. The soundtrack, this is some of the bands. Deep Purple, Aerosmith, Bob Dylan, Sabbath.
Sabbath?
Yep, right. ZZ Top.
I'm definitely going to watch that tonight, then.
Kiss, Alice Cooper.
Very much a rock soundtrack.
It's brilliant. Let's talk about the movie next week.
A slightly divisive choice, I feel this might be. I know not everyone's a fan of the next musician I've chosen, but... A Hard Day's Night.
Terrible choice.
The Beatles film. huge fan of the Beatles, so an entire soundtrack composed by the Beatles. Naturally going to be in my top three.
See, to me, that's kind of a cheat, because you've basically just selected a Beatles album there. I don't think that's a fair movie soundtrack.
Okay.
But no, you know, we didn't set any rules. We didn't set any rules about it, so you've made a legitimate choice.
You basically picked Guardians of the Galaxy, great. You've picked a Simon and Garfunkel album and a Beatles album.
Okay, well, you're lucky you got Guardians, because my first choice was originally going to be Walk the Line. Looks like a Johnny Cash best hits album.
Brilliant. I hadn't seen A Hard Day's Night till earlier this year. Everyone was banging on about how great it was, and I did love it, and I did go and buy the soundtrack, and it's a very, very strong album.
It's a nice
album.
Film. I watched it when I was younger, and, you know, I really enjoyed it. It's a very fun film. It's not something I'd obviously put in my top 10 films of all time, but it's got a great soundtrack for me. I love the Beatles. So
it's a fun film.
Is
it's
it similar good... to Spice World? I imagine it would be.
Not quite as
not
good.
Not quite. They can actually act and sing.
Really. Luckily, we've all seen that, then.
I think it's fairly obvious I haven't seen it, nor will I ever. No, well, but I'm ambivalent.
It's black and white, so Ben's got no chance of seeing it. He hates anything black and white.
Boring.
So we've had some good ones come through as well on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. And we've had a few come through on our Twitter, which is @STTEpodcast. So we'll start with Richard Booth, who said Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and A Single Man. I think they're quite scorish. I don't think they're more. Again, with Ben Sinclair, MacDonald, Amelie. I think that's quite scorish as well. So, Steve Swain, The Thing and Candyman.
I don't recall the music for either of those, to be honest. Thank you.
Yeah, you're going to hate this one. Steve Jordan, Forrest Gump.
I just hate everything about that film.
I do remember Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
That was one of the standout tracks for that, and that's got some really good kind of rock tracks on there. Paul Dawson, Lost Highway.
That is Trent Reznor as well. There's some Nine Inch Nails songs on there.
James Howe, Lock, Stock and Two, whatever it's called.
Two Smoking Barrels. Yeah.
That's a great soundtrack. Garden State and Empire Records. Sean Butler, Jackie Brown and Blade Runner.
Jackie Brown again, Tarantino.
Yep.
Yeah.
Someone's actually saying to me today, Death Proof, and I can't remember any of the standout tracks in that, but they was like, mate, that is a crap film, but the soundtrack's unbelievable, but I can't remember any of the tracks.
To be honest, he's probably right, Tarantino.
Yeah.
Hattie Finch has put The Commitments and Blues Brothers. The Commitments is a great soundtrack.
Yeah, it's
unbelievable. And that's it. So, yeah, we really appreciate those coming through.
Yesterday, we went to see A Most Wanted Man, a new espionage thriller directed by Anton Corbijn, starring the late Philip Seymour Hoffman as a German spy. The plot revolves around a Chechen rebel arriving in Hamburg and how the various government agencies of Germany choose to use him. So, as we've said, it starred Philip Seymour Hoffman. Before we get into the details of the film, what do we think about his performance? One of the final performances of him that we're going to see.
Yeah, very good, actually. Rather surprised. I know he's a great actor. This, for me, was a fairly good performance. It's probably not up to what he's done in the past, if I'm honest with you. But I thought he was very, very good, really.
I thought he was really good, but the worrying thing is the character that he plays, Gunter, he's a guy who clearly has a drinking problem. You see him drinking throughout the course of the film. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, he looked in the worst shape I've ever seen him in. And you think that it can't have been that hard to sort of channel that character for him.
Yeah.
And you're watching it through spectacles, knowing that this guy is now dead and died because of the various demons he had with drugs. And you're seeing him play this out-of-shape, alcoholic guy on the screen. And it was tough to watch.
That's all you can relate to. I wish the film had been nothing to do with the subject of him drinking, or I know he's not known for comedy, but something that wasn't so close to home. You're right, it really did kind of... That's the last kind of memory I've got of him now, that performance. I can't... You know, I don't want to... change the subject too far, but the last performance of Heath Ledger as the Joker, so it's so far away from what he was probably going through and all that. This is too close to home, and like you said, it was really heart-wrenching at times to think.
He did probably look tough. In the worst shape I've seen him as well, like you just said. He looked very overweight. And...
Yeah, I mean, he's always been a big guy, but he did look very out of shape. And you don't know whether that was intentional for the performance or if that's just the state the guy was in. We can only speculate on that.
It was difficult to watch. He could have just been that way. He could have been fine. You know, he just challenged the performance that well that
This, we'll never really know, I guess, but it did make it tricky to watch. But about the film itself, so Hoffman's character Gunter, the agency that he worked for, they weren't...
kind of official, it was government, Secret Service.
They were German spies, and they were sort of off the books. They do the jobs that the German government won't sanction.
Yeah, it's not within German law to do, I think, is the line he actually says.
And the other agencies that he butts heads with, they basically want to take this guy Issa, this Chechen rebel who's come over, because they believe that he's been involved in bombings and that he's a radicalised Muslim. And they want to take him in and arrest him, but what Hoffman's character Gunter wants to do is he wants to use him to reel in a bigger fish and then that fish to
reel in a bigger fish.
I mean, I think the analogy he uses was use a fish to reel in a barracuda and a barracuda to reel in the shark.
Yeah, yeah, I love that.
But that's a great analogy. But the other agencies don't see this. They just want the bird that's in the hand already.
Exactly. It's very much Gunter is after a bigger picture kind of thing. You know, the guys at the bottom are nothing to do with the guys at the top. There's, you know, three or four people in between. So if we can get this, you know, Issa in the pocket, you can get the bigger guy. I think it's Dr. Abdullah. They can get him in the pocket, and with him, they can actually get to someone meaningful.
Exactly, yeah, get to the sort of Bin Laden level guy.
Exactly, and once you get to the one that's meaningful, that's when you can start getting to the other guys that are meaningful as well around the networks, because I think his plan is the higher you go up, the more people these have contact with, and the more people you can get. But the other agencies, they don't see it that way.
Yeah. They just see the bird in the hand, and they
want to
take
that. It's very much no grey area there. It's bad guys, good guys. We want to arrest all the bad guys.
And one of the things I loved about the film, and I really enjoyed it, I'll put it out there, is I really like spy films. And this comes from a novel by John le Carré, who's really the god of these types of
things. Yeah, the god of the genre.
And the thing I love about spy films, proper spy films, is when you get to see spy craft at work. When I say spy films, I don't mean James Bond. James Bond's not a spy. No. James Bond is a mercenary who goes around with a gun. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we saw a gun in A Most Wanted Man. It was about proper spy craft. Yeah. It was about acquiring people to use for your ends.
Yeah, exactly. It was very much... And the kind of negotiation techniques, and there's a scene when they take Annabelle, the lawyer for Issa, played by Rachel McAdams.
Yeah.
They take her kind of, not prisoner, but they kind of put her up into a mini cell, and there's the negotiations that are going on. So Gunter comes in, he plays a bit of hardball first, gets her thinking, then... Erna, played by Nina Hoss, comes in, and she kind of plays a bit more of the good cop style. But then Gunter comes in and plays good cop as well. He sits her down. He just kind of says, "Look, we're trying to help Issa. We're not trying to arrest him. We don't want him. We want the bigger guys." So, as you say, it's that spycraft. It's getting people on side to manipulate in a way to meet your own ends. I mean, he does it with. The character of Jamal, who's actually this Dr. Abdullah's son.
Yeah.
He gets him on side early on as well to work against his own father.
Yeah, it's quite...
And as emotional it is with Gunter kind of saying, you know, you're doing the right thing, you know that Gunter doesn't care for this character of Jamal. He doesn't really care about him at all.
Yeah.
He's just a means to an end.
Exactly, and there's a scene where Gunter's in with some of the higher-ups in the German government, and he's also there with an American agent, Martha, played by Robin Wright. And he's talking about how what they do is they acquire these assets, and he uses a line like, "We become their friends and we become their lovers if we have to. And, you know, that's what it's about. It's about insinuating yourself in the lives of these people and using them properly. It's not about doing parkour and shooting guns, which is what the James Bond films will lead you to believe spy work is. I absolutely love stuff like this.
I don't think in that state Gunter could get around to only running around and shooting.
Inappropriate. For me, I'm not a massive spy fan like you, Ben. It's been a long time since I've been to the cinema and seen a film like that. The last few films I think we've all seen have been action and...
Yeah, you know, it was a nice break, actually.
It was a good change, wasn't it?
One of the standout performances for me was probably Rachel McAdams.
Yeah, she was great.
Stupidly, I always associate her with Mean Girls. but it's the film that, for some reason, I always just take her back. But I was... really impressed with her accent. That's one thing I was impressed with. So the consistent German accent that she had throughout the film. When she's alone with Issa, and there's just that moment of kind of earning the trust.
Yeah.
And you really saw her kind of, I think her heart was going above her job, and she was kind of thinking, I've got a few feelings here. And
yeah,
I can,
she was falling for the guy a little bit.
Yeah, and it was just, I really believed in that performance. I know the film everyone will be talking about for Philip Seymour Hoffman, but it was really kind of encouraging for me. And I think from this, I hope she does a lot more serious roles. I hope this is the step she needs to go on and do a lot more.
On the subject of that, Willem Dafoe as Tommy Brewer, the banker who's holding this money for Issa's father.
Yeah.
What did we think of Willem Dafoe's performance in this?
I thought it was good. I don't think there was a lot to it because he wasn't in many scenes, but I really enjoyed it. But I always enjoy Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, there are certain
actors that if they pop up in films, I always enjoy their work, and he's certainly one of them.
It's just a steady performance. I think he offers that kind of. There's a wonderful scene where he gets home after Gunter has kind of spoken to him. He's taken him in a cab, and he's not even negotiated with him. He's basically just threatened him. He's like he said, Gunter said before, we become their friends, their lovers, but sometimes they play hardball tactics as well. I mean, he threatens him with an audit of his bank and says, let's find out where your money's really coming from.
Yeah.
And gets him on side. He goes home to his wife, and there's clearly nothing between this Tommy and his wife anymore. There's no love, there's nothing. She just pours him a scotch and goes to bed and tells him not to fall asleep coming up the stairs. Just the kind of despondency on Willem Dafoe's face at that stage. I thought it's another great performance for him, even though he's not in it heavily.
He's got a great face for that kind of role because he's got really defined features.
Yeah.
That his facial expressions.
It's like he can show more emotion than everyone else.
Yeah, but there's a point that I wanted to go back to there, Mark, that you made about Rachel McAdams' accent. One of the things that struck me as odd is that this film is set in Germany and the majority of the characters are German. Yet they all spoke English with German accents.
Yeah.
I mean, it was obviously a commercial choice. Hollywood tends to think that films are more commercial if they're spoken in English rather than the native language if they're in a foreign country. But I don't know, I find that a bit patronising. I would have happily watched that film had they all been speaking German with subtitles. That wouldn't have affected me.
That's a good point, actually,
I agree with you. But like you said, I think the general public wouldn't have been.
But it's not a general public film. It was never going to be a blockbuster.
I think a lot of people would go and see it.
I think that's only on the fact that it's his last performance. I think
I think it's based on the fact that it's John Le Carré.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people did go and see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which was the last John Le Carré adaptation.
Because that was it was a TV series a long time ago, starring Alec Guinness.
Yeah, I think Alec Guinness was in it. Yeah.
So I think that drew a lot of people into that film, and I think that this name of John Le Carré would draw a lot more people into this one as well.
Yeah, you could be right. But I still think it was an odd choice. I mean, I don't think there were really many Germans in the cast. I think they were all Americans anyway. The one German, I think he's Spanish, half Spanish, half German, who was in the cast, was a chap called Daniel Brühl, who played Maximilian. And I think most people would be familiar with Daniel Brühl for his performance in Inglourious Bastards.
Oh, with Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, Christoph Waltz. He was the Nazi that became famous and started starring in films.
Oh, the sniper.
Yeah, the sniper. And he's in this film. But I believe he speaks one, maybe two lines. They just chronically underused him. Yeah, I don't know what. I kept expecting him to have a big scene towards the end.
It was just kind of in background shots. Like he was looking at monitors and things like that every now and then, wasn't he? But and then I think there was a shot of him in a car, just with someone else, waiting for something to happen. And it was just, I mean, he was very good in Inglourious. I remember his performance in Inglourious. And I actually watched it quite recently after our conversation about Hans Lander, because it's been a while since I've seen it. So I'm actually quite fresh on his performance in Inglourious, and I think he does appear to be a rather good actor.
Yeah.
So I agree with you there, he was chronically underused.
Yeah, and he's been in bigger films recently. He was also in the Formula One film Rush with Chris Hemsworth. He was in the film about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, The Fifth Estate. So it's not as if he's just disappeared since Inglourious Bastards. He's done big work. He's been around Hollywood, so it was odd to me that he was in this. And he was on screen a lot, but I believe he said one, maybe two lines.
I mean, he probably got really excited when they offered him a role in this. Like, you want to be in a most wanted man spy thriller set in Germany?
With Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Here's your script on a post-it note. You know what I mean?
Here's your two lines, you know. Unless his agent kind of wangled him in right at the last minute. They made a character for him, just scripted him in there for two lines.
What do we think about the direction from Anton Corbijn? I think he's most famous for The American, starring George Clooney, and another film, a really good film he did called Control, that was about Ian Curtis from Joy Division.
I've never seen that.
That's a really good film. Do you want that as your homework?
Brilliant, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. I love the band, so that's a film that's on the list, so yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Excellent.
Cool.
So yeah, I thought his direction was, I thought it was unflashy.
Some of the shots were awesome. Like just standard shots of Hamburg.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was about to say. Hamburg is such a great looking city because it's quite dirty in parts. Yeah. And there's a lot of graffiti and there's really sort of angular buildings and stuff, and it just looked great.
I must be honest, it made me kind of want to visit there.
I've been to Hamburg; it's a fantastic city.
Yeah, it made me want to go. So I might actually
next week's podcast live
from the Reeper Barn in Hamburg.
But yeah, it did make me actually want to go to Hamburg, and I thought he actually just portrayed the city in a nice way. And there's a lovely bit sort of down by the ports where Tommy and Gunter are talking, and Gunter has launched into a big speech about how for, you know, hundreds of years this port of Hamburg has welcomed everyone with open arms, but now no, we don't anymore.
Yeah.
So now every dark-skinned person is treated as a man who wants to kill us. And it's just incredible. It's a fantastic commentary, I suppose, on the way national security's become.
Yeah, after 9/11 and how things have changed.
I think you've got to be quite patient with his kind of movies. There's a lot of consistent one shots. There's not, when they're having a conversation, they'll just focus, they won't go between the two if they're having a two-way conversation, and he's not, I don't know, it's that film for me yesterday, you've got to have a lot of patience. There's a lot of dialogue, there's not a lot of action, that's the film itself, but his shots are it's all about the dialogue in that movie, and like you said, that it was so refreshing to see something that wasn't all explosions.
Yeah,
like you said, it's a really good point. I don't think there was any guns.
No, I don't think we saw a gun.
And like you said, no fast cars, no shootouts, and it was kind of
It was really tense,
and like increasingly so as the film went on. Like one of the scenes towards the end, I think you mentioned it, was the scene where they were in Willem Dafoe's office, in Tommy's office in the bank, and it's getting that
Dr. Abdullah
to sign some papers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And never would I have thought a guy signing a bank transfer would be such a tense scene, but it really was.
There's about 10 pieces of paper, wasn't it? And it got to the knife, and the pen, you could hear the scribble, and it's literally, he made a phone call, didn't he, about amendments.
Yeah, it's because the spies were banking on him making this amendment that would sort of prove the fact that he wasn't
with my
the
seat,
bad
my
guys.
Heart was racing.
It was a fantastic moment, because he keeps kind of going in between the van, where Philip Seymour Hoffman, Gunter, Erna, Maximilian, all are kind of sitting, waiting, watching these cameras that they've hidden around Tommy's office. And the other shot is actually through the cameras they're watching, which I thought was really cool. It's all sort of black and white, a bit grainy, and every so often the picture kind of jumps a bit.
I thought
that was very cool.
One of the things that I loved as well, going back to the spycraft and the sort of realism of it, is the cameras, the hidden cameras they used, and they hid some in the place where Issa was staying, is they weren't the kind of James Bond cameras that are like no bigger than a pinhead. These were quite chunky things that you'd think someone's going to see them, but this is probably the realistic nature of it. They don't have these invisible gadgets. They have these very realistic
smoke alarms,
things. You've got to hide them well. You can't just, you know, pretend they're not there.
And he's, I think there's one where he kind of opens up a plug socket, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he replaces it with a plug socket with a camera.
Yeah.
So what do we think overall then as a film?
Well, as I say, I'm a sucker for this kind of thing. I loved Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I don't think I'd put this up quite up there with it. Hoffman's performance was great, but I wouldn't put it up alongside Gary Oldman's performance in that film. I wouldn't be surprised if Hoffman got nominated for an Oscar, because I think the Academy does tend to like posthumous awards. So I can see him getting nominated, and he wouldn't be undeserved, because it is a damn good performance, but not necessarily his best. But overall, I'm going to give it 7 out of 10.
I'm going to go slightly lower, only because it's probably my own personal taste. I wasn't as blown away by the performance. I think I was expecting just a bit more. Now we've talked about it, 6.
Okay, I'm going to kind of turn around now and talk a bit about, I don't want to be too harsh on this film. Now, there's certain actors which, I mean, like Philip Seymour Hoffman, I know he's a great actor. He's a fantastic actor, and I know he puts in performance after performance after performance. The problem for me is, a lot of the films he does just don't interest me. So I'm talking stuff like Capote.
Yeah.
It's a great, it's a fantastic performance from him. Absolutely.
Well, he won the Oscar for that.
Yeah, but I just get bored by it. Doubt, I think, was the other one.
Yeah.
It just bored me. And I don't see this, or anything he does, as rewatchable.
No, that's a good point. I wouldn't want to watch that film you saw yesterday again. I have no need to. I won't buy it on Blu-ray and sit there on a night and want to see that film. Once you've seen it, for me, you know what happens. There's no rewatch value in that.
No, I mean, I agree. As much as I enjoyed it, I can't see myself ever watching that. I wouldn't agree that I can't rewatch any Hoffman film. Magnolia, I've seen dozens of, well, probably not dozens, but several times.
Okay.
And I would watch it again.
I mean, I think there's probably people out there who love Philip Seymour Hoffman that might be listening to this going, what is this going on about? He's an idiot. but I'm pretty sure that if you look into yourself right now, there is an actor somewhere where you feel the same way about. There is someone there where you just sit there and think, I can't watch anything with him in. Mark, can you bring any points to this?
Do you know what? You're right. I'm just trying to think the first name that comes to me. Probably, I'm trying to think someone who gets a lot of credit as well, who everyone loves. I mean,
Oscar nomination.
Yeah, Colin Firth for me. He's done nothing wrong, but it's his type of film. It's not just because he's a lot of Bridget Jones, but he often gets a lot of credit for, I think he did the King's Speech.
Yeah.
And I never ever really see him as anyone outside him being Colin Firth. I think if you saw him and tried to interview him, he'd be the same sort of guy that
same
is in all his films. And it's not criticising him because he's recognised and everyone else likes him, but
yeah, it's nothing to take away
yeah,
from the person.
And you're just right. He just, for me, he's my person that I just don't really ever have a desire to want to watch. And in a film, I can't ever. Yeah, I never get excited. And with Philip Seymour Hoffman for you there, that's a good point. You don't have to like him.
I'd quite like to put this question out to social media, actually, as well, and see if anyone else has any suggestions.
Yeah,
people they just can't watch.
Yeah.
It is personal taste. There's no right or wrong answer. There's no.
Well, weirdly enough, there were two that I used to have. Two actors that I just couldn't watch in anything. And then they both appeared in the same film, and ever since then I've loved them both. And it's Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio. I used to despise I used to really like Tom Hanks, actually. Let's go way back when he was doing films like The Burbs and Joe vs. the Volcano.
Okay.
I used to love Tom Hanks.
And Big, come on.
And Big, of course. But then he started doing films like Forrest Gump, which is an absolute piece of tripe, and I don't care what anyone says. He did things like Philadelphia, that I'm sure it's a very worthy, very good film, but I've no interest in it. So I just stopped caring about him. I just found him an annoying presence. I didn't want to watch any of his films. Leonardo DiCaprio, to me, was just the pretty boy from The Basketball Diaries and from Titanic, and I had no desire to see him in anything at all. And then one day, not that long ago, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was flicking through the TV. It was late at night, and I think it was on BBC Two, was Catch Me If You Can, Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks.
Your worst nightmare.
And I think it's directed by Spielberg as well,
yeah,
isn't it? And I don't particularly care for Spielberg films. So I clearly had nothing better to do, but I watched it, and it was superb. It was a great film.
Since that day,
I love them both. I will watch them both in anything, to the point now where Leonardo DiCaprio is my favourite actor working,
bar none. That's incredible to hear. That
Tom Hanks I'm a fan of now. I like him a lot, but Leonardo DiCaprio is my guy. He's the one who I will seek out anything he's done.
So what you're saying is Colin Firth needs to be in a film with Tom Hanks.
Yeah, I think that's basically it. Yeah.
Perfect.
But anyway, I think we've not answered what
no,
score
I'm
you
not giving
to
a rating.
Stop going off topic.
I don't want to be too harsh on it, and I thought if I give it something like a low rating, I wanted you guys to understand kind of why my thoughts of that were.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to give it, I'll give it a 6. I think that's fair. So, what, 6.5 out of 10?
No, let's just call it 6. It's me and him.
Alex, that's not how maths works.
No, we've got both at 6.
You know what? We'll go 6.5. 6.5 out of 10.
No, we don't give halves. Let's go 6.
6 out of 10.
Yeah.
Last week I briefly spoke about American Psycho 2 in our challenge, which kind of sprung up on the topic of sort of most memorable cinema deaths. This was all sort of sprung up because we were talking about Paul Allen's death, played by Jared Leto in American Psycho 1.
Yeah.
It was one of my most memorable ones. I often think it's brilliant. It's just the fact that he's kind of sitting there listening to Huey Lewis in the news while Patrick Bateman's laying all this kind of paper down, putting this see-through rain mac on, and he's just got this axe sort of waiting there behind the sofa, and he's just talking through the album of Huey Lewis in the news. So all of a sudden he just starts caving, basically, this guy's skull in with this axe, and I just thought it was fantastic to talk about our most memorable cinematic deaths.
So. And on that one, I would happily watch Jared Leto get killed.
We know about your thoughts on Jared Leto and how creepy he apparently is to you.
Yeah.
But that probably isn't my most memorable cinematic death. It's just something that's quite sparked the memory. And I think my most memorable one is probably Todd Voigt in Terminator 2.
Okay.
Nice.
Just the moment where John Connor's on the phone to his mum. Well, what he thinks is his mum, it's actually the T-1000. And Todd's drinking this milk. And you kind of see him mulling around in the background. And I think he's telling the dog to kind of shut up because it just keeps barking. And then all of a sudden you just hear a...
That sound is so good.
And then it kind of pans out during the phone conversation. And the T-1000's just put this giant metal sort of arm knife... through this milk carton, and you can hear the drips of milk
horrible
hitting the floor.
Brilliant.
It is horrible, but it's really memorable. And I thought that there are moments in films that kind of stand out like that. So how about you guys? Did you guys come up with anything?
I did. My all-time favourite and most memorable death scene is from Blade Runner. Obviously, in Blade Runner, Harrison Ford's character, Rick Deckard, has been chasing down the replicants.
Yeah.
And one of the replicants he's been chasing is a guy called Roy Batty, played by Rutger Hauer. And towards the end of the film, they chase up onto a rooftop, and Deckard nearly falls off the roof, and Batty saves him and pulls him up. And at this point, Batty realises that his life cycle's to come to an end because the replicants only last 4 years.
Okay.
And the whole point of this, the whole point of the next bit of the film is that Batty wants Deckard to realise that he's not just a robot.
Yeah.
He's had memories, he's lived a life, and those memories are going to be gone forever, like tears in rain, he says. Time to die. And then he dies. That's the end of his life cycle. No dramatic death. He doesn't get shot. He doesn't get blown
up.
It's
just memorable for you.
That's just the end of him. And the power of that speech, the fact that his memories will be lost like tears in rain, it's such a beautiful speech, and it still gives me goosebumps.
Yeah.
The first line of that speech is, "I've seen things you people wouldn't believe." And the hairs on my arm come up every time. Rutger Hauer has never been better. And one of the best things about that speech and that whole scene is that he ad-libbed it. He had a script, and he went, "Yeah, this is no good. I'm going to do it my way."
That's amazing.
And the whole tears in rain thing, he invented that. He ad-libbed it. It's beautiful.
I think that kind of brings up an interesting point there about memorable deaths in films. They don't necessarily have to be overtly violent, like in Hostel. I think a lot of people's memorable deaths are like Final Destination or Hostel or something like that. They don't have to be bloody and gory.
No.
Just something as brilliant as that, a speech.
Yeah,
before
a memorable
just
speech.
Generally passing away, you can kind of do it. Mark?
I've actually not seen Blade Runner, but no, I'm joking.
I was about to kick you out then.
So, this was a real difficult one to kind of single out. After me changing my decision probably 3 or 4 times today, I'm going with it now. Here we go. Ridley Scott's Alien.
Okay.
I'm sure you know when John Hurt is... for some reason, he's come out of that coma, hasn't he, after being attacked miraculously. No.
What's this bit?
Have you not seen that either? For some reason, got really bad digestion. as you know, he goes and lies on the table. And the next thing we see is, well, his chest being ripped open.
What's memorable about this scene?
We have
unusual
an alien,
choice.
We have the alien run out. And I'm sorry, but there was nothing that stuck with me as a scene final death.
Joking aside, that is probably one of the most memorable deaths.
Oh, hell yeah, it's a phenomenal scene.
Just that whole scene is incredible, where he starts sort of writhing around and they're pinning him down on the table.
Yeah.
And I love the little sound that it makes. I think it actually got named a chest burster.
Yeah.
I think they actually ended up calling it. So you've got the face hugger, which is the first stage.
They were very literal with the name. Yeah.
And the chest burster. Was the so it kind of just flies out. It's that little noise it makes, like, before running off.
I think that's the exact sound, yeah.
Well, I actually did the sound for the film.
Fantastic. But, yeah, there's nothing else like it, really. I mean, that came around, and I suppose there's nothing else in the cinemas that you'd seen. I know you get some sort of spoof films now kind of mocking it, but, my God, go and watch that scene again, even if it's just on YouTube. Absolutely... Terrific.
As you've already said, as a kid, when you first watched that film, I think I was about 12 or 13 when I first watched it. And that
great parenting.
My parents didn't know.
They do now.
That scene is just horrendous when you're that young. You're just sitting there like, what's going on then? I think I had fears about eating for about a month. I don't anymore.
So was there any other kind of deaths that were...
really hard to say no.
I mean, Sean Bean in anything.
Yeah, because he does die in everything.
And he dies in fantastic ways, isn't
it? What hit my favourite one of his, have you ever seen Equilibrium?
Yes, yeah.
That's a great film. His death scene in that is cool.
I think the standard is Boromir, Lord of the Rings, but he's got about 8 arrows in his chest and he's still fighting on. I know you don't like it, but it's a great... But to be honest, probably the second choice I had was Christopher Walken in The Deer Hunter.
Oh, nice.
Wow, that's a... Yeah, I'll just casually say it, yeah.
It's just an incredible day. It's that the Russian roulette.
Yeah. Did him out
with De Niro, and he kind of finally gets through to him just as he's about to pull the trigger. But I think that moment he kind of realises that this is what he wants. He doesn't want to live on anymore after everything that's happened, and that for me it was kind of a close second. I was really, really struggling with what I should put first.
For me, the Batty's death in Blade Runner is far and beyond everything else. Mm. So my second is a distant, distant second, and it's a very different kind of death. Have you seen Deep Blue Sea? There's a scene in Deep Blue Sea where the characters are in some sort of aquatic centre, and they're all arguing between themselves, and Samuel L. Jackson's character takes them to task, saying that we need to pull together, we need to work together. And he tells them a story about how, when I think he was in the Arctic with a team, and they were facing insurmountable odds, and they survived. And as he's giving this dramatic speech, a shark in the moon pool behind him jumps out and bites him and just kills him. And it's hilarious, because you do not see it coming. It's so unexpected.
Now you've said it, would you like to swap that with Blade Runner?
No. But it is a good thing.
I agree with you. I remember the first time I saw that. It was such a shock. I literally just... I think I sat there for about a minute, not really understanding anything that was going on in the film afterwards. Because I was just sitting there with my mouth open. Like, what's going on?
Yeah, hilarious.
For me, the one I really found hard to put down to second was Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. So, the famous shower scene.
You're going with all the hipster choices today.
I know.
I think anyone would have chosen Alien or Alfred Hitchcock's The Psycho.
But I just... That scene, again, it's just unbelievable.
You're talking about the shower scene.
The third shower scene, he got excited.
But no, the fact that you hardly see the knife... Well, I don't think you do, do you? It's the silhouette,
it's the suspense,
the shadow,
isn't it?
The kind of... Yeah, the sound, the build-up, and it being black and white... just the music and everything that goes with it.
One of the great things about that scene, I think the actress was Janet Leigh, correct me if I'm wrong, but that she was a really sort of A-list actress at the time. She was in big movies, and Hitchcock cast her in this and then killed her off in one of the first scenes.
Yeah.
And this was unheard of. This kind of shock tactic happens now, like the Scream films tried to do it in the first scene of every Scream film. But at the time it was unheard of to kill off your A-list star.
Good on him,
brave.
Yeah, and that was Hitchcock.
That's what he did, wasn't it? Yeah. Interesting enough, I just want to bring up one point about memorable deaths. For kind of tense scenes and just suspense, anything by Anton Chigurh.
Yeah.
We mentioned him last week as one of your most memorable villains. And any scene in which he's hunting someone down...
With his bolt gun.
..is so tense that, again, they could all be kind of put up there. Woody Harrelson's death in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Definitely up there for me as well.
One of the gremlins when it gets put into the blender.
In the blender.
Me, that was amazing because not only did he die, he got splattered all over the whole house. And, hey, that was quite scary.
So we've kind of halted the conversation up until this point. So anything from Twitter or Facebook?
We've had some really good ones coming this week. So thanks again for all those people. Stu Pickering has said, The Wicker Man. The ending scene to The Wicker
Which
Man.
Which one? We're talking the original, Edward... the Nick Cage version.
Oh, God.
Because the Nick Cage when he's got the bee helmet on.
With, is it Edward Woodward?
Yeah.
That's harrowing. That's absolutely horrible. And he's also put Jar Jar Binks in his head. So, nice.
I think we've all imagined Jar Jar Binks' death over and over again.
No doubt.
Pete Heppel has said Bambi's mum. To be fair, for Disney,
it is memorable.
Back in that day, that was awful.
I'm not going to argue that it's not a memorable death. Everyone seems to remember it.
John Porter's put Tony in Scarface.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, definitely. Tony Montana, definitely. Yeah.
We've had Laura Goodrum, and this is an unbelievable choice. American History X. The teeth on
Curbstone.
The
curb. Curbstone. Yeah. Oh, yes.
That's one of those ones.
Don't sound so excited about that, Ben.
That is one of the moments where I must have rewound that. The sound of his teeth on the actual curb.
It's harrowing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the word of this podcast, harrowing. But yeah, it really is horrendous. Mad Dog in the Raid by Tony Ridley, and he's also said your point earlier, Drew Barrymore in Scream. And anonymously, we've had Pappy, who was ran over in Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2. So, no idea who's that. Oh, and we've had Darius Cobb, Paris Hilton in House of Wax. Glad she died. She ruined the film.
Oh, yeah, because I imagine a film called House of Wax would have been brilliant if
with Paris Hilton in.
Oh, some strong points there from Darius Cobb.
So thanks to all those people. And remember, it's facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. And on Twitter, @STTEpodcast, if you want to contribute or have any questions for next week.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
Lads, it's homework time. So last week our homework assignments were I was going to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I had Office Space.
And mine was Nymphomaniac.
That is the correct word, yes.
The prequel to the mistaken film by myself.
Let's leave it there. Yeah. Adam, Office Space, thoughts?
Wasn't too sure. No, it was,
idiot.
It was incredible.
Oh, God.
Absolutely loved it. It was so funny. Yeah. Oh, by the way, Milton, you're a twat.
Do you not see the resemblance?
No, not at all.
It's the way you talk.
But no, I thought it was fantastic. I see what you mean about Gary Cole now as well.
Mm-hmm. Lundberg.
Just, it was weird because there was nothing really standout about the film in general, but it was incredibly funny, it was really relatable, and there was just, the whole film as a whole just worked.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'll be just.
I have to agree with you on that.
I have to go ahead and actually
that was it. It was kind of the characters were there were brilliant, and I love how he, you know, the scene where he goes in to the kind of the business consultants, and he just doesn't care. He's like, "What do you do all day? Nothing. I just kind of sit at my desk and stare at my screen all day. I don't do anything." And they end up promoting him.
Yeah,
they want him in kind of middle management. It just, it's kind of like everything that's wrong with business summed up in a film. And like you said, I've worked in an office for the past 5 years, never seen Office Space. Now I just think, yeah, I can see people in my own office like that.
Yeah,
to be honest.
I think that there's that cultural thing about if you've ever worked an office job, you have to have seen the TV show The Office, the English version. You have to have seen that to be able to empathise and understand it and see yourself or see other people or see scenarios and situations you've been involved in. And I think Office Space is very much like that. No, I think there's a universality, is that a word? Let's say it is. If not, I've coined it. There's a universality to it that you see a lot of you or situations.
Or people you know. Hate.
Yeah. And obviously we see Milton every day, Adam seeing you.
Well, so. That's the funny thing, isn't it? If you ever meet anyone, you're like, do you like The Office? And they're like, no, you've not worked in an office. Because you can't tell me that you can't like The Office. And
exactly.
You say, everyone's worked with a Keith.
I know people who, you know, they didn't like The Office. And so they started working in an office, they rewatched it, and then they enjoyed it after that.
You get it then.
There isn't very much kind of relatability about it once you have worked in an office. And I imagine it's a lot similar to Office Space, where if you've kind of sat at a desk from 9 to 5 for months and months on end, feeling like you're not really getting anywhere, you do kind of feel like the feeling in Office Space. Especially Milton being moved.
Yeah.
Desks.
Well, we've all been in a situation where we've one of our spreadsheets has not opened, or our computer's just not saving. How much did you love that scene where they go outside and smash the computer with baseball bats and stuff? And we've all been in that situation where we are just...
Exactly.
Oh, let me do that.
One of the things I did particularly love about it, and this is a spoiler for the ending, is when the office burns to the ground.
Yeah.
And you know Milton's done it because he's taken the money.
He's just walking off like, yeah.
He's walking off. And then it cuts to him later and he's kind of like in the Bahamas or somewhere like that. And even though he's, you know, he's finally stood up for himself, he's still not a strong character. The guy brings him the wrong drink and he's still sitting there going, and the guy just walks off, gives him the drink and still walks off. He's like not listening to him. I thought that was incredible.
Yeah.
The soundtrack for that film as well. Don't get me wrong, it's not in the all-time top
favourites. Take a job and shove it.
It's cool. It's
some really
cool.
Good rap music on there, and it's just, yeah, listen to it if you get a chance.
Jennifer Aniston surprised me by being
in
it.
She's really good in that, yeah.
She's awesome in it. Overall, really enjoyed it, guys, so yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm glad for that, yeah. It's one of my all-time favourite comedies.
And I'm not Milton.
You're not Milton. Let's be fair, you're not Milton. You're not you're not that bad.
I don't wear glasses.
I don't care what
I'm not that fat.
Yet.
So my homework was Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Now, this is a film that you've managed to avoid for several years.
Well, yeah, I mean, the film is 33 years old. I'm 31 years old and I've not seen the damn thing. And having watched it now, I consider that 31 years well spent because I really, really didn't like it.
You're dead to me.
If I'd have seen it when I was seven, I kind of see why, why I may have liked it or why you guys liked it as kids and like it now historically. But at my age, in my 30s, I just don't care about a swashbuckling archaeologist.
Doesn't, it must be. The thing is, I can't put myself in your shoes and say, you might be right. Maybe if I only watch it for the first time now. Do you know what, Ben? I might be completely going against everything that this one of my favourite trilogies ever. You might be right. I can't
comment. When was the last time you guys watched it, Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Probably Christmas time.
And did you really sit there and enjoy it, thinking this is one of the greatest?
But it might be that whole
childhood memories.
It might be that mentality of, I remember being seven and loving it and wanting to get a whip and run around and, you know, be looking for treasure and this having a boulder after me and running around, you know.
It's something I've kind of discussed before in a similar way. We were talking at work today about comedy films and we were saying how a lot of the time when you're a kid and you grew up watching a comedy film, you prefer them than the ones that have come out recently because you grew up with them. So I think that might be the case. Maybe it's just we've grown up with it.
Yeah, I think that's most likely what it is. You know, maybe if I'd never seen Star Wars and only watched it now, I wouldn't care for it.
I doubt it.
Obviously. But going back to Raiders, one of the things that disappointed me was that some of the iconic scenes that I've heard so much about or seen clips of, they've been built up so much in my mind that they were just chronic disappointments. The boulder scene towards the start.
Yeah.
I was expecting this to be this momentous thing that would go on for ages and, you know, ducking and diving, avoiding it. And it lasts about 20 seconds and it's like that boulder's clearly made of papier-mâché. Didn't like it. The scene at the end when they open up the Ark. And look, I know this film was made in 1981. I know this wasn't the height of CGI, but the ghosts that come out of it are some of the most pitiful graphic work I've ever seen.
I suppose when I'm seven watching it, I was terrified.
Yeah, that's fine. And I know I should judge this through 1981 glasses. I shouldn't judge it through 2014 glasses, but I can't not. And I just didn't enjoy it. The thing I enjoyed the most about the film was spotting really young actors. Like Alfred Molina was in it, a very young Alfred Molina. And but no,
do you have any desire to
not
watch
my cup
the
of
rest?
Tea. No. I've seen the first and the fourth. I've seen enough.
I'm really sorry you haven't enjoyed it, but
I hate you for making me watch it now. I think less of you.
A rave review from Ben there.
Put that on the DVD cover.
So not at all, nothing for you.
No, rubbish. Move on.
So Harrison Ford in a tight archaeologist outfit with a whip and a hat, there's nothing for
to
you.
To me it was just a weak ass version of Han Solo. You know, get your blaster gun, do a real job, put the whip away. No, nobody wants a whip.
Sorry, yeah, I forgot about those blaster guns, doing a real job.
Right, so from that glowing review, I watched Nymphomaniac. Now,
please, how did you feel?
2-hour film. To be honest, I remember there being quite a bit of controversy about this film last year. Everyone was saying how, obviously it's going to be full of sex, and they had quite a few famous cast members that you were quite surprised would go in this film, especially
Shia
LaBeouf.
I
was really, the one thing I will say, Charlotte Gainsbourg, who's known for being a musician, was outstanding. She was the main lead role. I don't know if you guys have ever watched this film. This story is, we find her look like she'd been raped or beaten up, and it's the story of how she got there. So she's telling this person that finds her a whole life story from the age of, I think she was 12 when she lost her virginity. It's full of sex. It's not as kind of, yeah, it's kind of not as, I expect it to be really full on and really shocking. Like, oh my God, these sex scenes are really
graphic,
really graphic and kind of disturbing. But it wasn't. There was not as much sex as I thought. No. I don't want to see Shia LaBeouf pounding away. It's not what I wanted to see. But I'm happy to go out, and if people want to argue and say I'm clueless, but it was terrible.
Don't pull your punches. What did you really think?
You know, the director, is it Lars?
Lars von Trier.
Oh, dear God.
So, you know, this film for me, I'm glad I've seen it because now I can give an honest opinion. There's a second part which I probably won't bother. He's over, in my opinion, completely overrated. I'm sure the people at the Telegraph and papers will love him because he's the cool director that's different.
Yeah, he's arty. The art set, he's the director name
that people throw out when they want to people to think they know about film.
Yeah, like Mark said, like The Guardian and stuff. The arty, farty arsehole.
The guy who's on his iPad in Starbucks with his skinny latte with his...
I don't
weekly
think
the manuscript he's reading through will tell you that he's brilliant because of. Have you seen Antichrist? Yeah, I have seen the Antichrist.
It's terrible.
Biggest pile of rubbish,
rubbish I've ever seen.
I actually spoke to someone at work about Antichrist, and he described it as the best comedy he's ever seen.
Yeah.
Well, the bit where the fox that has managed to eviscerate itself turns to the camera and says, "Chaos reigns." That was hilarious.
It's ridiculous.
I think that was supposed to be scary, but it was hilarious.
It's just. I mean, he is one of those directors who I've actually watched about. Four films, probably, I think, Dogville, Antichrist, Melancholia.
Oh, that's the film I was
with
thinking
Kirsten
of
With Kirsten Dunst, yeah.
I've not seen it, but I was trying to remember the title. What's
I've not
that
heard
like?
Any of them.
No, that looked just bleak, but I just... Any good?
No. They're all terrible. He's overrated. He's terrible.
You've seen more than I've seen. I've seen Antichrist and one other that the name escapes me. But one of the accusations that gets levelled at von Trier all the time is that he's a misogynist. That there's just that his films are just anti-women. Having seen more of them, can you see any of that in what you've seen?
There's a lot of women being raped and having sex, being used as sex objects. So yeah, I can kind of see that. Dogville's kind of a prime example of that. If I'm completely honest,
is that Nicole Kidman?
Yeah.
In
the end, she kind of gets her own back on the town. She ends up being the daughter of a mobster. He burns the entire town to the ground. But to be honest, it's shit.
The whole kind of theme for Nymphomaniac is they use the woman as basically the power of her vagina is related to the bait of a fisherman. So every time we see, so there's a famous scene in this film where she's on a train. She's only about 16, and she's got a competition with her best friend who can have sex the most on this journey. And as she's given this guy sat opposite the kind of eye of, hey, how you doing? We see the bait being lowered into the water, you know, with a famous, like, with a maggot being put on. And then we see the fly fisherman pulling on his rod. Not the scene in the actual train. But then we genuinely see her taking him in the toilet and
pulling on his rod.
Yeah. But no, and it's so pretentious. Like, one of the scenes is they talk about how they can use different baits in different ways, and then the woman would talk about how she can use, like, hand stimulation or oral sex as a different way of winning the guy over. And it gets to the point where you're like, I am sick to death of this pretentious crap. Like, just, I don't have any interest in this at all. And when you said about the way he kind of portrays and goes against women, this girl in the film, spoiler, she loses her virginity at either 14, and he basically shows how she's just a piece of meat. So she loses her virginity to some guy that she's only just met, and then he turns her over and kind of aimly rapes her. And it's pretty sickening to see. And this girl's first experience of having sex... This is, sorry, not a very nice podcast.
It's a family podcast, this.
But it's pretty harsh. And, you know, for her first experience to be kind of raped and...
To be honest,
It's horrible.
Fed up with talking about
this.
Well, let me just say one thing before we get... This will make you even more fed up. Is one of the scenes that you'll remember from Antichrist is the bit where the main woman, who I think is Charlotte Gainsbourg again... she's in the middle of having sex with her partner, and she's in the middle of an orgasm, and because she's enjoying it so much, she allows her, I think her baby crawls out of a window and dies, and because she was in the middle of coitus, she didn't stop herself and go and save her kid. And again, it was just rampant misogyny about this woman, and it's horrendous, unwatchable
shit. Well, I'm glad I'm sat here with two other people right now that agree completely, because I'm sure there'll be people out there that will go, you guys know nothing, he's a master at cinematography, the way he got that fox to turn around and say that line, you don't understand, it stands for the freedom of people. No, it doesn't, it's bollocks.
Get your iPad out, carry on drinking your caramel frappuccino.
Skinny tall. Skinny tall frappuccino, if you don't mind. Extra hot, extra latte,
extra foam.
One shot.
It, as I say, he's the director that people pull out when they go, oh no, I know a lot about film. I've seen two Lars von Trier films. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, where are you going tonight? Well, I'm going to London to the premiere of his latest film.
Well, it's, you're the one that's bought the ticket.
Yeah,
there,
it's a 2.5-hour epic battle about a man with a jack-in-the-box, and he basically, it's his life, as he turns the wheel, you see the suspense of his childhood, and in the end, when it finally goes off, you realise he was dead the whole time. What?
It's just terrible. It's absolutely awful. It's a bit unprecedented. It's something we've never done before. I want to give Lars von Trier a skip to the end director rating. Mark?
I'm just not even going to try and be cool. Just one. Just he's just nothing to me. He's just terrible.
Ben?
Nil. He's a nil for me.
He's a minus one for me.
Oh, you just had to go one there.
I did.
And do you know what? And I'm being serious now. Facebook, Twitter. We've got an email address as well, which is skiptheend@icloud.com. Drop us a line. If you want to argue about this or you really think he's brilliant, tell us why, because we might not be getting it.
Yeah, if someone can put forth a cogent argument as to why we are entirely wrong about Lars von Trier, you go right ahead.
We'll
read it out next week.
Yeah, do you know what? I will as well.
In all fairness, he hates women, so he's probably not getting it.
Right, brilliant. That's that done. So we've had a question come through this week on our Facebook, which is facebook.com/skiptheendpodcast from Ben Sinclair McDonald. Following on from last week, he said, why is it so hard to pull off a really good sequel?
Well, that's an interesting question, actually.
It is an interesting question. It's a tough one to answer. I think, first of all, the reason why it's hard to pull off a sequel is if there has been enough commercial response to your first film to have the ability to create a sequel, it means the first one was good. Then you're always at a disadvantage because you need to make a film that is as good, if not better, than the second one. So you're automatically at a disadvantage. If there's no film yet created, you're about to start a new franchise or a one-off film, you're starting from a level playing field. But if you're creating a sequel, you have a bar that you have to try and reach and get over.
I think the other thing for me is, and this is something that The Godfather 2 got right. It's difficult with an original film. You introduce the character and you give them a backstory and you make people care about them. With a sequel, you struggle to do that because the character itself is already established, and then you then have to choose kind of a secondary character to bring in and introduce. Yeah. Now, The Godfather 2 had De Niro as Vito Corleone, showing you his past. And that was really interesting, showing that alongside the narrative of Michael Corleone going through and doing his business with Hyman Roth. So for me, I think one of the standout points is when you're establishing a character, people find that interesting and they like that. They like seeing the backstory. If we take Spider-Man, for example, I know you're not a huge fan of him, Ben, but if you look at the first film, it was a commercial success because you get the introduction to Peter Parker, you get the introduction to Mary Jane, and everyone gets a backstory, and you hear about, oh, this is what happened, and you see it on screen. Well, the second film, you're coming in, and you kind of have to start on the front foot straight away and immerse people in the action. Now, in Spider-Man 2, again, they chose a character in Dr. Octavius. Good introduction, gave us a bit of background on him, and a bit of a story as to why he becomes who he is. But there are so many sequels that just get that completely wrong. They either zoom in on the wrong character or give them a poor backstory. And people don't respond well to it, and it just feels like the film loses any kind of depth to it.
For me, I think my perspective on it is, so it's a really good question. So when you're making a film, say for example, I'm just going to pick the first one that comes to my head, Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've got Jim Carrey and
Jeff Daniels.
They're given this script. It's the first time they're ever going to get to play this character.
Yeah.
You've got the company not really knowing if this is going to be a hit or completely bomb. They have the success. It really works. These characters have this complete take on it. So you get to be these crazy, mad, stupid best friends that you can only create at that time because you're at that stage of your life. Now, I'm only picking this because I know that it's coming out again this year, the follow-up. if you leave it 10, 15 years, Jim Carrey is a completely different man now. He's gone off and done Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He's done a lot more serious roles. Now, I don't care how good you are of an actor, if you've matured and you've grown 10 years older, or 15, or maybe 20, or however many years it is, to go and revisit and try and find that stage of your life again where you can relate to that character, where you can put everything into it. I don't care who you are. The company know it's going to make money, so you're not really going to be working as hard, I don't believe, as a company. I think you're going to be there saying, do you know what? Let's just do this. And it is like a cash-in, like Anchorman 2. Yeah. They're not going to want to, is this going to be great, and have that excitement. And to go back and be that character and get into that mindset, because you've probably had kids in your personal life, you've got married,
you've changed,
had success, you've had money, you're living in somewhere else in the world. I honestly don't believe, however good you are, De Niro, whoever it is, the best actors in the world, it's impossible to find that mindset again of that stupid 25-year-old mad kid.
I think that's a really fair point, and we're not a music podcast, obviously, but I think that's something that affects musicians as well. You get musicians who are young and hungry, literally hungry at some points. You know, they're starving musicians. Yeah. They put out these fabulous albums. 10 albums down the road, they're multimillionaires. They're married to Gwyneth Paltrow or something.
Yeah.
And how can they possibly have the same level of artistic integrity they had when it meant more? One of the other reasons why I think sequels are so hard to pull off is because often they suffer from diminishing returns, because the companies that make them seek to make carbon copies of the original film.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to do something different. So let's use your example of Godfather 2. It's in essence similar to Godfather 1, but in practice it's different. You've got that dual timeline thing. But an example of a film where they just tried to copy the first one and it was diminishing returns is the Hangover trilogy. The first Hangover film is really funny, a good film, interesting film. The second one is exactly the same film but worse.
Just in a different location.
Yeah.
Just kind of making the point. I think this is something that comedy sequels struggle with a lot, more
absolutely.
So than any other genre.
Yeah, yeah.
If you take the example of Anchorman, Anchorman was a fantastic film, absolutely brilliant. Arguably top 10 comedies. So when they release the second one, it's kind of like they are trying to copy it a lot. It's a lot of the jokes in there, they're different but similar.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different settings, but Ron Burgundy is a no one now, and he's assembling the news team back together and they're going up against other news teams. And there's a bit in the second one where they go into, like, a news team fight.
Yeah.
But in the second one, it's just so drawn out. I mean, you've got cameo after cameo after cameo. There were cameos in the first one with the news team fight, but it was short, it was sweet.
And I think in that first one, there's a bit where, you know, Brick has got a trident. It's like, where's he got a trident from?
Yeah.
That's funny. But then in the over-the-top one in the sequel, there's a bit where a guy's got like a laser gun.
He's
or
got
a
laser gun
in
the future.
Like, you know, you've just tried to one-up your own joke and it's not worth it. It's diminishing returns.
It's a funny film, Anchorman 2. It's not necessary.
It's fine, it's funny, but why did it exist? As you say, it's not necessary. It did not need to exist.
I think you're right with the whole fact that comedies suffer the most.
Yeah, they do.
The action films and superheroes and all your Marvels. I want to know where Captain America's going to be in 5 years. I want to know what happens after he gets with the Avengers. So
comic books are kind of a cheat on this, though, because they have source material already there.
There's a lot, there's decades worth that you can pull from.
I mean,
from.
If you look at the Russo brothers who are doing Captain America, when the first one came out, they kind of already knew where they were going with the second and third, because the narrative of Captain America's there. Action films, a lot of the time, just aren't as good either.
Just cash in after cash in, like you said, Die Hard in
the air. Well, you know, the first Die Hard is a work of art, violent, ridiculous art, but the sequel is just Die Hard on a plane or Die Hard in an airport. Mm. And then Die Hard with a Vengeance, the third one, I love. I think that's a fantastic movie. But then the two after that are just atrocious. It's just an excuse for Bruce Willis to be a grumpy man with a gun.
But it's PG.
And they're PG, yeah.
I think that what I really like is the fact with sequels is the fact of the film that the perfect sequel is the film you never get, in the way of, I wonder what that character's up to now. And I know we're talking about TV, but The Office. We left The Office at series 2 really wanting more. That's the best way to do it.
Mm.
Comedies for me, I can't think of any top, like Napoleon Dynamite, the way that ends for me, I'm left thinking, I really wonder what that guy's up to now. Road Trip, it worked as a one-off. We don't want another Road Trip. We don't want, unfortunately, they did it with American Pie.
They did do another Road Trip.
Did they?
Yeah.
What was that one?
Wasn't it called Euro Trip?
Oh, yeah. God. Well.
Vinnie Jones is in it, I think.
But if we're left wanting more, that's why these standalone films, you know, V for Vendetta, stuff like that, the one-off films, don't cash in and go for other movies and just try and...
I mean, I'm going to throw this out there now. Empire Strikes Back. it was different.
Mm-hmm.
They changed it. The dark side won at the end of it.
Yeah.
It was, it left you thinking that was, you know, it's completely different as a film, and it was a success because of that.
Yeah, it was a darker film.
So if any production companies or movie companies are listening, don't just try carbon copies. Do something different. Exactly. Go out there, and people will respect your sequel more.
Yeah, you cannot avoid the law of diminishing returns if you just try and make the same film over and over again. It won't work.
People have seen it before. They might laugh again, but...
There are exceptions where it will work. Police Academy, Rocky...
Oh, well, of course. Police Academy 6, Mission to Moscow is...
that's number 7, man. Come on.
I do apologise that my Police Academy knowledge is not up to scratch.
Your homework is to watch all 7 by next week. I will test you on which episodes Hightower does get involved with other characters. But no, we can't really answer it. There's a few different reasons I think we've come up with here.
Valid points.
Yeah, right? I think it was a really good question.
If there's anything you do disagree with, obviously... Drop us a line
drop
on the
line.
The standard
Matrix
social media.
Revolutions is the also...
It's clearly the pinnacle of the Matrix franchise.
Cheers,
thanks for the question.
Cheers.
Adam, you've mentioned a couple of times there about best comedies, and I think it's about time we did, as a topic, our favourite comedies. So how about next week we do our top 3 or top 5, maybe?
I think we need 5 on this.
Okay, yeah. Top 5 comedies next week.
Sounds good. Great.
Let's do that.
And if anyone on the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/skip-to-the-end or Twitter at STTE podcast, want to contribute, we want to know your favourite comedies of all time. We've also had one more question come through the Facebook page this week to Tom Hill, who's asked, what's our favourite guilty pleasure of a movie? That film that is embarrassing to kind of admit to your mates... That film that you shouldn't really like, but you secretly probably watch.
Is it something that's been critically panned? Or
yes, that kind of... Something
like
everybody,
a universally bad
you know
film.
It's a terrible
but
film.
But you enjoy it. Okay.
So like someone who really enjoys a Kevin Smith film, for example.
Masterpiece.
Tusk.
To be fair, let's think about this, because this is a question that I think is going
to
need
gonna say,
time.
I think I need till next week, probably, to come up with something like that.
So next week, topics of discussion are our top 5 comedies and our guilty pleasure movie.
Yep, sounds great.
Cool.
Okay, well, last week I set a challenge for you guys to try and find the worst film starring a wrestler that you've ever seen or could ever find. Mark, what have you got for us?
Well, instead of revealing the title straight away for you guys, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the movie. This is taken off the back of the DVD.
Skip to the end.
So, are you ready for this?
I'm excited.
The world was destroyed in a nuclear war many years ago. Now, the human race has begun almost wiping out common frogs that have mutated into intelligence. Starring the wrestler... Rowdy Roddy Piper, Hell Comes to Frog Town. Well, I mean, I'm going to throw it out there now, not anytime soon. I think we should watch this one night.
I love the Hot Rod, so I'd be up for watching that.
To be fair, it looks like it's about a town being absolutely covered in... Well, I'm going by the cover here. Frogs with machine guns and shotguns look about the same size as humans. They're taking over the world, and I only think that Rowdy is the man that can probably address this problem.
Well, I mean, to be honest...
I don't want any spoilers out there, but I mean...
You know, if like the mayor calls you up and says, look, the town's been overrun by murderous frogs with shotguns, who are you going to call? It's Rowdy Roddy Piper.
I can't think of anyone else that could handle that. As long as he's wearing his kilt at the time and he's...
Hot Rod t-shirt.
Yeah, bagpipes.
Fully loaded. Then he's the guy. I mean...
Hell Comes to Frog Town. The annoying thing about that is that Roddy Piper was in a film called They Live, and I know you're a horror aficionado,
mate,
Mark,
John
so
Carpenter.
I bet you've seen it. Yeah, and that's a good film. I don't much care for horror films, but that's a good one, and Roddy Piper's brilliant in it. So it's a shame that he did really poor films like Hell Comes to Frog Town as well.
A new breed of enemy. I mean, to be fair, there's probably not going to be a remake of this anytime soon.
Should have been a first make.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, not anytime soon. We're going to watch this as a group.
Sounds good. Maybe we'll review it on a podcast in the future.
Special 2-hour special.
So, come on, Ben, beat that.
I think I've set the bar pretty high.
The film that I have chosen, or the film that I found, is a film called Santa's Sleigh. Now, at this point, I must inform you that sleigh is not spelt S-L-E-I-G-H. It's spelt S-L-A-Y. This film stars former WCW World Heavyweight Champion Bill Goldberg
as a
homicidal Santa. Yeah. And the story behind this is that Santa was actually born of the devil. And then I think, I did read up on this, but I really wish I hadn't. He got into some fight with an angel or something, and then the punishment he had from this angel was for 1,000 years he had to give out presents. The 1,000 years has just run out, so now he's reverted to his original devilish incarnation, and he's off killing people.
Amazing.
So,
the Santa's thing is, slaying, I actually want to Bill see Goldberg. This sounds funny.
I don't think you do.
I've been very quiet on this because that's the one I found as well.
Brilliant.
It was most definitely the worst thing I could find. Just to elaborate a bit more on that, he actually loses a curling match to an angel.
As you do. He's sent to
1,000 years of delivering presents to children. And I kind of did a bit of research on this because I didn't actually want to watch it. I mean, I think I actually do after reading about it. That's the interesting thing. Because it's Christmas Eve 2005 and this is the year where his 1,000th year is up. And he comes down a chimney to a family, the Mason family, I think it said they were called, and they're having Christmas dinner. I don't know why they're having Christmas dinner on Christmas Eve. Seems a bit silly.
It's a tad premature.
It's the first plot hole I've found.
There won't be any others, surely. It'll be a very tight script.
It'll be a tight script after that. But Santa stabs Mr. Mason's hand using like the turkey fork. He ends up impaling someone Spoilers. With a Christmas star in the back. But it turns out that one of the characters' fathers, who's been seen as kind of a crazy old man, has been building a Santa-proof bunker because he found some ancient scripture from 1,000 years ago which details the bet. And he knows that 2005 is the year that Bill Goldberg Santa is time's up delivering presents. And it just sounds amazing. So Hell Comes to Frogtown and Santa's Sleigh, we have to watch.
Christmas Eve, my house.
I've already been told that apparently one of the bits that's just absolutely brilliant is Santa checking over his naughty list, and apparently he looks at the camera and says, "Who's next?"
Oh my God.
Seeing as you've chose the same one as me, and seeing as you did more research than me, but I'm going to pick another one. Now, I've not looked this up, so I'm doing this from memory. I believe there was a film called The Condemned, which starred Stone Cold Steve Austin, who is the greatest wrestler of all time. Don't argue with me.
Shawn Michaels.
Well, this is a debate for an entirely different podcast.
It
stars him, and I believe it stars alongside Vinnie Jones. And I think the premise of it is they're convicts on an island and they have to kill each other and the survivor.
The winner gets their freedom.
Yeah. So it's yet another Hunger Games Battle Royale film.
Yeah, amazingly,
but with Steve Austin.
I've actually heard really good things about this film.
From who? Steve Austin?
No, from someone
Vinnie
like
Jones.
WWE.com.
Yeah, from WWE Studios. I believe they call it the better version of Battle Royale.
Now I find that...
No, I'm joking. No one ever said that.
Because that is a claim you can't back up.
No one can back up that claim.
So, challenge next time then.
Right, chaps, this one's going to take a little bit more explaining than the usual one.
Okay.
What I want us to do this time is I want us to find the worst rip-off movie. Now, I want to tell you what I mean by a rip-off movie. I don't mean...
Not as in I spent 50 quid on this, Ben.
I don't mean a film that costs you a lot of money. I don't mean Hunger Games is a rip-off of Battle Royale. What I mean is a film that is quite clearly a rip-off of an existing property, or, so that we don't get sued, let's call it an homage. I'll give an example of what I mean. You're all familiar with RoboCop.
No,
unbelievable.
Never seen it.
It's a famous franchise, Adam, look it up. Bloody Milton. there is a film coming out, the film that came out in February of this year, straight to DVD, of course, called Android Cop.
Incredible.
And I urge anyone out there to go to YouTube and look up the trailer for Android Cop. And it is a rip-off / homage, of course.
There was another one for Pacific Rim. I can't remember what it was called. Like Atlantic Rim or something like that.
Oh, I remember seeing this, yeah. It was pretty much the exact same premise, but it just had a different first word.
So we've got to find... Should we try and get two? You've got to come back with two each.
Why?
Just because I like these films. They make me laugh.
Okay.
They always make me laugh. Okay. I really do find them funny. And they do it about 6 weeks after it's just come out of the cinema. And I don't know how they get away with it.
Yeah. So because Mark didn't bother to actually do his work and come up with a challenge. He's decided to scupper mine by saying we have to get two each. Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted.
So we're going to come back with two rip-off / homage movies to existing movies.
Okay.
Amazing.
And that brings us to the end of yet another episode of the Skip to the End podcast. Next time around, we're going to be reviewing Gone Girl, the new film from David Fincher starring Ben Affleck.
Can't wait.
And then we've got a couple of topics. So first, Mark?
The top five comedies of all time.
And Adam?
We'll also be looking at what our favourite guilty pleasure films are. Films that have been panned by critics, but we're embarrassed to admit that we love.
We've also got our challenge that we just set, where we're going to look for the worst rip-off movies, or worst homage movies, let's say, so we don't get sued. And then we've also set our homework, so I'm going to be watching Dazed and Confused. Adam?
Singles.
And Control.
So, tune in next time. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Mm.